Here at the podcast over the years, we've learned a lot from our winemaker friends in Napa. John Kongsgaard remembers visiting Bordeaux winemakers and learning from them before Napa's big wine boom.
France in those days was very interesting because they were, at that point, completely unthreatened by us. So you could go, I would go to Bordeaux every year for 10 days, visit 25 wineries, and they were much more open to me than they were to one another. You know, the guy would say, you'd be at Garode La Rose and he'd spill the beans on their racking schedule and how long they left the wine to macerate and so on. And he'd say on the way out, whatever you do, don't tell the guys at Latour what I'm doing, you know, because they really did not talk to each other. They probably do more now than they did then, but they certainly were open to Americans. I think we were just kind of funny that somebody from California was coming. We were like the three-legged cow. Look at this winemaker from California. No kidding. So it was great. Each year I went with a list of questions. I'd go to Bordeaux and I'd say, okay, this year we're going to talk about Cabernet Franc and Petit Verdot. We're going to talk about how long do you macerate your reds before you drain the tank. These fundamental questions that nobody had a clue on here. There was a kind of tradition, maybe Andre Chelichev knew what to do, but that nobody was tapped into the French tradition. So I was trying to find that, and they were very generous.
Well, recently we called up some of our sommelier friends to see what really gets them excited about Napa Valley wines. For a limited time, a bunch of them are cherry-picking some of their favorite Napa Valley wines and pairing them with the specialty burgers at their restaurants. The idea, called Somms and Sliders, brings two great things together. Passion for wine and delicious burgers. Julian Moreno of Bowery Meat Company tells us about his Napa inspiration, a bottle of 1933 Inglenook.
Myself and other Somms that I used to work with decided to treat ourselves with a bottle of Inglenook 1973. And that experience literally blew me away by the power and structure that the wine had. That is the main reason behind my support to Napa Valley Wines, and that's also why we are very excited here to participate in Somm & Slider for the second year in a row. At this occasion, we will pair our 40-day dry-age beef burger with Napa Valley Cabernet Sauvignon Faust 2013. I hope you'll take the time to visit us, and on that note, enjoy the rest of the day, and cheers.
A 40-day dry-aged burger? I'll take two, Julian. So, folks, you know what to do. Check out everything going on with Somms and Sliders and taste your way through some special hand-picked Napa Valley bottles. To learn more about how sommeliers are using Napa wines in restaurants, in particular with burgers, visit www.sommsandsliders.com. SOMMSANDSLIDERS.
Some really big news from 750. They've announced online ordering. Ordering on 750 is more than just simply adding items to a shopping cart. It's actually a complete order management system that streamlines the process of creating, sending, and tracking all of your orders to all of your multiple distributors. The best part of all of this is that it's designed to fit into your existing email ordering process, the one you already have. And you get to still work with the same distributor sales reps that you always do. But now there's less confusion for everyone because what you have intended to order becomes automatically generated with detailed product information inside of the message. Also, order history with each distributor is stored on 750. That way you can easily reorder previously purchased products with just a simple click. This is the greatest. It's exactly what everyone has always wanted in this profession. And if you're excited to be working simpler and with less confusion, 750 has you covered with a great new ordering platform. If you have not already signed up for 750, you should check it out. 750.com has more information about a better way to do business with less headaches and more effectiveness. Check it out. 750.com is going to save you time and make you more effective at what you already like to do. I'll Drink to That, where we get behind the scenes of the beverage business. I'm Levy Dalton.
I'm Erin Scala.
And here's our show today. Vittorio Fiori on the show today of Poggio Scaletti in Tuscany and Castelluccio in Romagna. Hello, sir. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Very nice to have you here.
Yeah, thank you.
Your history working with Sangiovese goes back quite some time, actually.
Yeah, my profession starts a long time ago. In the 90s, I bought my first winery in Toscana. But I came in Tuscany in the middle of the 70s. In that time, I was director of the Italian Association of Enologists in Milan. And a friend of mine asked me to follow as an enologist his winery in Greve in Chianti. So the weekend I came there, 70s, in the middle of 70s. It was a completely another world, a viticultural world. In Tuscany, the vineyards were almost abandoned. They planted the new vineyards with 2,800 plants, but after 10 years, they had 1,500, 1,800. So the production was... but the production was still big. Why? Because they asked to the plants, the vines, to produce 10 kilos each vine, you know? And so, of course, the quality of the master was unbelievable down, you know? The climate was not the climate we have now, but most of all, the mentality was not what mentality we have today, you know? Because in that time, even the authority, they push the producers to plant vineyards to be care with the machine, to reduce the cost and to produce a lot. Very like wine, you know, able to be sold at very low price. This was the mentality, the direction in which everybody went to go. Because the mentality was to say, okay, if I have to make a gift to my doctor or my advocate, I buy a French bottle of wine and I give it to them. Nobody talk to give a bottle of Italian wine in that time. But fortunately, a very important journalist, Luigi Veronelli, starts to write about wine in the newspaper. But it was no politically correct to speak about or write about wine. Wine was on the table, was on the bar, was everywhere, but a lady could not go in a bar and ask a glass of wine. No, because it was forbidden. Because what was not, you know...
It wasn't a refined, classy thing to do.
Exactly, you know. And so the wine, even the editors, they don't want to write about wine. But Veronelli tried step by step to increase the interest of a consumer to read something about wine. Because... the knowledge about wine was very, very low, even in the people. Even because wine was, in the time, like other food, very popular. Milk, bread, polenta, wine, all at the same level.
A staple.
Yes, exactly. Veronelli said, no, we have a potential, as all the other people, they live in the area, and they were able to produce wine. And so we have to increase our potential. And step by step, I remember, because in that time, there was no this small producer able to produce high-quality wines, even for himself. But the small growers, they produce wine to drink at the table, not to export, not to sell, even in the Italian market. This job was in the hand of big producers or cooperatives, you know, and they didn't produce any high quality wines. So Veronelli made a paradox, and he said the best wine from the industry is much worse than the worst wine from the growers. And so it was a shock, but we needed a shock, otherwise nothing will change, you know. And so when I started to have the possibility, to have the responsibility to produce wine, I decided, first of all, to change what it was possible to change in the vineyard, and to change the technology in the cellars. But it was much more easy and much less expensive to change the technology in the cellars than to change the viticulture. Even because the viticulture, apart the investment you have to make to prepare the soil, to buy the vines, and so you have to wait 4, 6, 7 years to have the first return, you know. And so in that moment, we made enology, I call it a correction enology, to correct the nature, because the nature wasn't able to produce big wine. We didn't give to the nature the possibility to produce a very good wine. So starting to make a new style of wines, because I have to make a parenthesis. In that moment, in the 60s, end of 60s, came the regulation about the DOC, you know. 63 was the big law. And then starting from 66 and 67, they came the new rules for each. But even in that case, they make a big mistake. Why? Because they started with the mentality. They were sure that what we had in that historical moment was the maximum we could made as quality in the wine, you know, was completely stupid. We went at the level zero, not the level 100, you know. But they didn't understood that problem. And so they put a lot of rules, and they still are in the regulation today, with the goal to maintain everything like that, you know. The whites in Tuscany had to be made with Trebbiano, the Chianti with white grapes in the Chianti. Why? Because the Baron in the 1700 said, but it's not true, because if you read really what Baron Ricasoli said, he said, if you want to produce a red wine light to be ready soon to drink, you put white grapes. Otherwise, if you want to make a reserva or something to live a long time, you have to respect 100% Sangiovese. But nobody, or not all the people, knows this particular, you know. And this mistake was at the base of the naissance of Super Tuscans. Why? Because nobody recognized himself in the law. And so they go out of the law to produce table wine. I remember I was in charge from the region Toscana to make a presentation, wine tasting. And they spent, in that time, they started to spend a lot. I mean, we had in the 80s, starting of 80s, and Regione Toscana spent a lot of money to promote the wines. But I was charged to go, for instance, in Japan, in the United States, in Germany, in Norway. But the wine, they give to me to present was the wine from the cooperative, the wine from the friend of the politic, the wine. And I said, no, don't tell me to present this wine, because I remember one time I was in Tokyo with a functionary of the region, the Tuscan region, and we tested the wine before the tasting. And we said, no, we cannot present a wine like that. So we went to a shop, an enoteca in Tokyo, and we buy with our money because the region didn't give back the money. We bought three bottles of Sassicaia, and I don't remember, probably Tignanello or something like that. And it was a successful.
Big success.
Of course, yeah. It's a big success, you know. Then when we came back, we said to the region, no, you have to make a filter before, a public filter. I don't want to be the responsible for the choice, you know. You make a wine tasting, everybody could participate, and only the wines over a certain point, they can benefit of the public money, you know. And it was successful. No one more in the world could say something negative about the Tuscan wines in this promotion we made. But the problem of the Super Tuscan was a big problem because nobody wanted to be inside in the DOC because it was not profitable, you know. And so remaining outside of the DOC gave the possibility to use other kind of varieties, new varieties. I call new varieties. You can read French varieties, Cabernet, Merlot, Syrah, Petit Verdot. And those wines, the vines able to bring to the producer enough money to start to invest in the vineyards, in the cellar, in the technology, in the enologist, even because the figure of the enologist was not very known, you know. Why? Because the enologist until that moment went only in the big wineries. They had the possibility to pay them, you know, to give the salary. And in that time was very important the figure of a consultant. I started to be consultant in 64. I think maybe I'm the first consultant in viticulture and enology in Italy. In north of Italy, I was in Piemonte, close Novara, in that area. And I one day I said, "But why I have to work only for one winery? I can give suggestions to many wineries. They spend each spend less money. Me, I can obtain a very good profit." And so I started with six, seven, eight different wineries. And when I came in Tuscany, I started again to be a consultant. And we went only three after two or three years in the 80s, Franco Bernabei, Maurizio Castelli, and me as consultant. Because the big wineries like Cecchi, like that Antinori, of course, Frescobaldi, they had inside an enologist. You know, the luck of Antinori was the mind of Piero, because Piero understood that in Italy was almost impossible to find the right mentality to increase the quality of the wine. And so he went, Giacomo Takis already in force, you know. But he went to France to bring Peynot. Emile Peynot came in silent, nobody knew that. And Peynot, of course, went the responsible to introduce Cabernet in Bulgari. The use of small barrels, French techniques, Bordeaux techniques. And that was the key to win, you know.
So green harvest and more ripening too? Was that Peynot
too? Of course,
too?
Okay. Of course. The team, Peynot and Giacomo Takis, very clever man too, he understood immediately what was possible to bring out from Émile Peynaud, because Émile Peynaud was a volcano of ideas in order to... Because Peynaud was not a professor of a university, studying to become a professor. He was a cellarmeister, a practitioner, and he studied in the evening to become a professor. And so he passed through all the steps to produce wines, all the problems we could have in the cellar, in the vineyard. And so it was really a person able to transmit global informations about wine, no? You know, because maybe a professor is able to aid in a specific sector, but that doesn't have the total view of the production process, you know.
But let me ask you, what was Giacomo Tacchis like? I mean, as a person, what was he like?
He was a very clever man. He was an enologist, studied in Piemonte. He came from Piemonte. And he came in Tuscany in the 60s, in the same time when Émile Peynaud came here. And he and Peynaud started to experiment Cabernet Sauvignon, first of all in Bulgaria, in Sassicaia, because Solaia didn't exist. And why? Because the family, the owner of Sassicaia, the Incisa della Rocchetta, are relatives with Antinori. And so they said to the Antinori's family, if you want to use our soils to plant vineyards, please do that. And so Piero, Giacomo, and Peynaud, they made this new project. I remember I came here as a director of Italian Association of Enologists. We made a meeting with the Tuscan enologist, with Giacomo Tacchis, and he very... I don't know in English, I would say timido. Timido means a little bit afraid, you know. Give us to taste this experiment called, probably the name was not yet found. Then it became Sassicaia. But it was already a very important impression about that.
So it sounds like there was a generation of change, really. There was something happening. And also in the ownership model, right? Like sharecropping was moving
away. Exactly. That was very important. It was time in which, the 80s, in which many people from industry, probably people coming from countries, they went to Milan or to Rome, and they made a lot of money with industry, and they wanted to reinvest money in the field. So they came back, and they bought destroyed properties, abandoned the properties with a very very low investment, but they invest a lot to rebuild, to make a new cellars, wineries, with that time was not so expensive like today. But they introduced stainless steel tanks, they introduced press, filter, and the figure of enologists, because the enologists became more and more important to guide the process of production quality wines. And so we became, after in the 90s, in which we went on the top of the economy was very good. The other markets, most important, the United States markets, it was some import from the States to start to import wines, high quality wines from small wineries. And so American market started to know this reality. So in that time, a lot of, how I said before, a lot of people having money invested in our activities, viticultural and enologists, to make new vineyards, to use the new discover of science. For instance, in the case of Sangiovese, we saw that in the end of the 90s, the Consorzio of Chianti Classico made a project of selection of clones for Sangiovese. And we passed from 20 clones before and 130 today. And this was very important, not only in order to increase the quality of each clone, but to find also the best position in order of plantation for each clone, or the best clone for each position. You know, the quality in general was in increasing. You know, at that point was very important also the function of the climate change, even because we studied the new clones in order with the climate we had in that years, in that time, you know. But, I mean, what was the goal for the Sangiovese? What to anticipate the maturation? Because in October, when became the maturation in the time of Sangiovese, started to rain. And so we had many vintages bad because of the rain. Or we had to spritz a lot of products against botrytis, because the rain means botrytis. And so we had very good clones able to be mature before, to resist to the disease. And the environment was much better, with less disease, with better climate. And we today, of course, we have to recognize that new varieties when planted, as Chardonnay or Sauvignon Blanc and so, and they, of course, this kind of varieties are maturation more anticipated in comparison to the reds. But today we start to harvest even in August, you know. 15 years ago, 30 years ago, it was no one could think to harvest in August or in September. You know?
So it was a combination of the climate change, the clones changed, and the farming changed. And exactly. When you add those three things together, they add up to a lot more ripeness than any just one of them.
Exactly. With other problems, for instance, the problem in the reds today is to achieve at the right point of polyphenols maturation, avoid to have too much sugar, because the polyphenol maturation becomes after the sugar maturation. And so waiting for the polyphenols maturation, we have the increasing of the sugars. And that means that the authority, the UA, made a law which permit to de-alcoholize the wine, because is really a problem today. It's frequent to find new wines with 15.5 degrees, and it's impossible to put wine like that in bottle.
But so tell me, how did you end up in Greve in 92 with your own property? I mean, what happened that you started moving from consulting enologist to someone who has his own farm?
Okay, as you can imagine, working so many years in consulting job, I asked me why I could not have my own winery. So I went to see this this property. It was so nice. It was there the a vineyard of 3 hectares planted in 1925. So I was in love with them, but very nice position. Everything was okay. Fiore family buy this property. And so we started at the beginning with 5 hectares of vineyards. Yuri was still in Burgundy to study.
That's your son?
My son, yes.
Who works with you now at Poggio Scaletti.
Poggio Scaletti. And he came in 93. So I bought the winery. We started for the beginning with Il Carbonaione from the very old vineyard.
The 1929, right?
Exactly. And which was one of the first vineyards planted after phylloxera destruction, because the phylloxera destruction became at the end of 1800. And then in 1915 became the World War One, and so every all the men went to the war. And then in that time, the French universities found the solution for the phylloxera. And so we started to bottling Il Carbonaione, because I decided to call wine Carbonaione. And the first vintage was 92.
It's really good. That's like my favorite Carbonaione. I really like the 92.
Oh, yeah. And this was a very difficult vintage because started to rain at the beginning of October, and until Christmas was rain. But we went a very small surface quantity, and so in the calling relatives and friends, in 2 days we had the grapes in the cellar. And so we started to this adventure. Then the years after came Yuri with me. I had the possibility to enlarge the winery. Now we have 15 hectares in total.
So what about the Il Carbonaione, though? How did you make it, you know?
So in that time, no one, one writer gave more than 92, 93 points to Sangiovese. But the Merlot, 100 points. Sangiovese. Of course, the situation in the Chianti Classico era is not very good, because the term Chianti is a penalty. Because in the mind of the people, Chianti is popular wine. And so they don't understand why they have to pay 12 euro, 13 euro, etc. Started 3 or 4 years ago, to propose to the Consorzio Chianti Classico to maintain Chianti Classico very small, but to emphasize the name of the village. Lamole, Ruffoli, Panzano, or the other area. But it's a big war. Why? Because the négociants, they don't like that, because they cannot have 10 labels. So they buy Chianti Classico and they call it Chianti Classico. You know? So the consumer knows immediately if he's a commercial or is a producer, you know, because the producer call it with the name of his area, and the commercial could not do that.
So at Poggio Scaletti,
yeah,
when you do the Il Carbonaione, what are you fermenting?
In tanks, not so large, 7,000 liter size. And we tried at the beginning to maintain the identity of each vineyard. And then after the Malolatti fermentation in December, normally My son and me, we are going to taste the wines to look at the analysis and so on. And we decide, first of all, if the Carbonaione production is okay for the vintage. And then to take the best lots we found in all the vintage, you know.
And you said that you have to be a little careful with the anthocyanins of Sangiovese, especially in the beginning, the process.
Oh, yes. There was a researcher, Rocco Di Stefano, very important professor of the University of Torino, and he found that during the first steps of fermentation, there is a compound called acetaldehyde, which is able to connect it with anthocyan. And this connection become a substance which fall down. So he said, because of to release the anthocyan in the must is very easy at the beginning, because the anthocyan are soluble in water, not even in alcohol, but in water. They come out from grapes immediately. So if we wait a certain, not time, but a certain activity, fermentation activity. When the yeast was able to transform around 10% of sugar, after that the acetaldehyde transforms, you know, and so there is no more the risk of this combination. So after this time during which the yeast consume 10% of sugar, we don't touch the tank. We don't make a pump over. So after that, we start with the restage. The restage, you know, is to transfer the must, the liquid, in another tank, leaving the skins in the same. And then putting back the must over the skins with an hydraulic movement, not a mechanic movement, to avoid any mechanic action on the skins, because any mechanic action produce solid part in the must before and the wine after. And that means some vegetal note which could remain in the wine at the finish. You know? Another way to obtain a good extraction is to cool the grapes after crushing the grapes until 10 degrees, and to maintain this temperature for 10 days, making a pump over twice a week. And then we leave the temperature to increase until 15, 16 degrees, and then we put yeasts, and the fermentation starts. And we obtain, we made at the beginning a comparison with the same grape in two different tanks. And the system with the maceration, cold maceration, had at the finish in the wine more than 30% of color in comparison to the other.
So it sets the color better.
Yeah.
So what's been the difference doing Sangiovese in Tuscany versus Sangiovese in Romagna? Because you also have Castelluccio in Romagna.
It's a question of climate, because of in Romagna the climate is higher than in Toscana in the time of harvest, starting from September. The temperature there is much higher than in Tuscany, so the sugar concentration is much more. And probably I find the Sangiovese of Romagna more round not so rich in tannin. Even in the acidity is not so high. Romagna Sangiovese much more soft, much more round. Anyway, more difference.
But it seems like a big difference in the market, you know, between.
And in the market, play a role the region, the name of the region. All the production of Tuscany is high, even if it's not very good. All the production of Romagna is unknown, as people look at like a poison. No wine writer are writing good scores for wine of Romagna. But not only Romagna. Marche is the same thing. I don't know. Umbria, same thing. Lazio. In Italy, if you have to buy a winery, please, Toscana or Piemonte. Don't spend money. And Toscana and Piemonte, they have people like Antinori, like Frescobaldi, like Inciso della Rocchetta, so who made the image of the Italian wine. In Piemonte, we have Gaia, we have Mascarello, we have a lot of people able to sell the wine more than 100 euro per bottle, you know. Of course, this remains in the mind of the people.
But you also make white wine in Romagna, right?
Yes, a wine called Ronco del Re. In that case, at the end of this 70s, yeah, 70s, I received a call phone. Good morning, I'm Gian Vittorio Baldi, and I'm a director, movie director, and I bought a property in Romagna because I was born there, but even I work in Rome. I was in Rome too, and he was he had the mentality for a new project to find one of the most important element in that job. You know, for instance, he went to university to ask. Who's the most clever student you have in agronomy? The professor said that. And so before laurea, he asked to plant the vineyard. In architecture, the same was in Rome. He built a very nice house made by Renzo Piano, who was a student at the time, you know. He called me, we met us, and he said to me, I have around 7 or 8 hectares of vineyards planted by this young agronomist. And I know that you are a good enologist, and I would like to make the best wine of Romagna. Okay, we can try. And so he, already in that time, he made single vineyards, even if the property was very small. And in fact, the different wines are called Ronco del Re, Ronco delle Ginestre, Ronco dei Ciliegi. And on the label, there is the picture of the vineyard where it's produced. And apart Sangiovese, he told me that he had a very small surface, less than half hectare, in which he told me he planted Sauvignon Blanc. And so I said, okay, but in that time it was no the cellar, very, it was very pioneer, you know. And so we said, okay, we can try to obtain a good white wine. So for a couple of wine of year was impossible because one time I arrived too late in the vineyard, so the concentration of sugar was too high. Another time, I don't remember what's happening. Anyway, the third time, I was able to pick up the grapes in the right moment. But in that year, the total quantity was very, very low. From a half on half hectare, we obtained no more than 150 liter of wine. 150 liter. And so I said, okay, anyway, we can look what we obtain. So we put this wine in three big bottles, Damigiane, 50 liters. And I said, okay, put this Damigiane in a room without door, only deck, but without door. And then came the winter, snow, because there is the snow comes a lot. And so I went back in the springtime. I went there, I made work and so. And in the end, the worker said to me, Mr. Fiore, you remember the tree Damigiane? Damigiane? Oh, my God. I forgot. Anyway, I said, okay, we can give it as gift to the workers. But before it's better taste, maybe it's vinegar. And so he brought to me a glass with this wine. No. I said, no, please, this wine could put in bottle because we can give 1,000 lire as a gift to the workers, but this must go in bottle. And so I bought a small bottling system with a siphon and all open, plain air. And so we put the bottle on the table, the bottle, the Damigiane, on the table, and down we
siphoned it off.
Gravity, we full the 200 bottles, more or less. And it was very, very good result.
What did it taste like?
Oh, very rich, very round, good body. Not taste of Sauvignon Blanc, not a characteristic of tomato or something like this. Anyway, after a month, we brought two bottles and we went to Luigi Veronelli. And I said, Gino, I have a surprise for you. Oh, I didn't tell the history. And
you didn't tell him this is the wine I forgot. You didn't tell him that?
No.
I almost gave this to the workers. How do you like it? Yeah, that's good.
And he said, after he tasted the remains, wondered, and he said, you have to sell this wine no less than 15,000 lire. In that time, in the early 80s, one bottle of Barolo cost 800 lire. So 15,000 lire was an unbelievable price for an Italian wine. But this mister, the owner, was very, very good marketing mentality. And he was able to promote this wine and was able to put this bottle on the table when came Khrushchev one time in official visit in Italy. And so, you know, the fame of this wine was very known. And we still produce now, but unfortunately we had to replant the vines because it was too old. But we don't obtain the same style of wine. Anyway, it's a wine
very able to live long, 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 long time. We tasted vintages of after 20 years, perfect, fresh like a wine bottle 2 years ago. And anyway, was one of the best performers I had.
How do you see things changing in the next 10 years? You know, you've been in Tuscany for 40 years, and you've been in Romagna for several years as well. How do you see things in the next decade for Italian wine and for those two regions?
Well, in the next 10 years, we have to consolidate our situation we have now, because, for instance, we have a big successful of El Brunello di Montalcino, Nobile di Montepulciano. Unfortunately, Chianti Classico is still one of the lower price red wines, DOCG, in Italy. We have to find a solution for that problem, because also the Chianti Classico area is a cultural area. We have Firenze, Siena, we have all the most important situation of the Italian history. And so it's stupid to have the possibility, the potential to have big wines and don't have the condition, because of the competition we have from other wines which use the name and they reduce the importance of the Chianti Classico. You know, we have to fade in that direction. But generally speaking, I think the Toscana will remain one of the leader production good wines in Italy. Piemonte too. The other region are able to increase their possibility, their potential of quality, but for them it's very difficult to create the image which already has Tuscany and Piemonte.
Vittorio Fiore has been in Tuscany for over 40 years, in Romagna as well, and he's looking ahead to what could be in the future for Italy as a whole. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Vittorio Fiore of Castelluccio in Romagna, Poggio Scaletti in Tuscany, and numerous consulting engagements throughout Italy. This interview was made possible by Vinitaly, the world's largest wine fair, held each year in Verona, Italy. Daniel Jonas and Peter Leem have announced the third edition of La Fête de Champagne, which takes place November 3rd through the 6th of this year in New York City. La Fête de Champagne's program has always included a series of excellent educational seminars. This year they've included three standouts. The first is a tasting tour of Champagne with Peter Leem, focusing on terroir, grape varieties, viticulture, cellar practices, and producers. There will also be a dosage masterclass with Alexander Chartonia and Terry Thies, where guests will get to examine all aspects of dosage in a practical context. And there will be a tasting of Pinot Noir Terroir, featuring producers who are known for their skill with Pinot Noir, including Michel Drapier, Charles Philippinat, and Jean-Baptiste Geoffroy. La Fête de Champagne will culminate with two really cool events. There'll be a grand tasting of over 100 different champagnes at the Metropolitan Pavilion on Saturday, November 5th, and there'll be a Champagne Gala Luncheon at Restaurant Daniel on Sunday, November 6th. For more information or to buy tickets, visit lafetdechampagne.com. That's LAFETEDUCHAMPAGNE.com. That's lafetdechampagne.com to hear more about the third edition of La Fête de Champagne happening in November in Manhattan. Before we go, we have some people to thank. A big thank you to Rob Moose and Thomas Bartlett, who wrote and performed our new intro music. Go to robmoose.com, that's robmoose with two O's, .com, for more information about a very talented musician. Of course, we couldn't do what we do here without the help of Aaron Scala, who does the warm-up segments for this show. You can find her own blog at thinking-drinking.com. And Alder Yarrow's excellent website, vinography.com, V-I-N-O-G-R-A-P-H-Y, posts up write-ups and warm-ups for this show, as well as other tremendous content. We are proud to partner with Crush Wine and Spirits in Manhattan for our wine club, offering regularly discounted wines that we feature on this show. You can write to me directly at levyopenswine@gmail.com, levy with an I, openswine@gmail.com, to find out about joining our wine club. And thanks to the many of you who have already signed up. Also, thanks to all of you, our audience. Together, we have heard from some of the most fascinating people in wine, and they opened up their hearts and their minds to you and me. You can let us know what you think on our Facebook page. Find it by searching at Drink to That Pod. You can also find us on Twitter at Drink to That Pod, or you can check out the pictures on Instagram at Levy Opens Wine. We love iTunes comments, and we love iTunes subscribers. If you subscribe, you'll see our episodes in your feed much earlier, sometimes even as much as a day or two earlier than you would otherwise, and you'll be able to listen to every episode since number one. That's about 400 episodes since we first got started. If you have an Android phone, you'll be happy to know that we're on Google Play Music as well. Our own website is alldrinktothatpod.com, I-L-L with no apostrophe, drinktothatpod.com, and you can find information there about buying a fancy IDTT t-shirt or a seasonally appropriate hoodie. You can also get information on the website about donating to this show. Donations have really kept this thing going, and you can help do that. Thank you, and see you next episode.